Welcome, everyone, to The Deep Dive. I'm Lee Graham.
And I'm Sam Hurst.
Today, we're embarking on a deep dive into an entire issue. The Washington Post for Friday, August 15th, 2025. Our mission, as always, is to extract the most important nuggets of knowledge and insight from a full stack of sources, which in this case is a whole newspaper.
Right. Think of it as your express lane to being well-informed without all that information overload you usually get.
Exactly. We'll be digging into the core facts, exploring the why behind the headlines, trying to connect the dots between stories that might seem separate.
And really dissecting the wider impact, the implications of the news shaping our world. We're looking at everything, national policy, global dynamics.
All the way down to local community stories and cultural moments, too.
We'll try to cover what was truly making waves on this particular Friday.
So settle in, because we're about to deliver a truly comprehensive, exhaustive, and detailed report of what was making headlines. Let's unpack this. So as we open up today's Washington Post, one of the first things that really jumps out is the powerful political currents shaping the nation.
Yeah.
And right at the forefront, we see some really significant shifts starting to, well, redefine the very role of government.
Yeah.
Especially in crucial areas like health policy and science funding.
Absolutely. This section immediately flags some pretty profound moves. Moves that could fundamentally alter how government interacts with public health, with scientific research. And it raises some big questions about scientific independence and, you know, the nature of public trust itself.
Okay, so first up, the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS. They're reviving a long-dormant body, the Task Force on Safer Childhood Vaccines.
Right. And the Post makes it pretty clear this isn't just some routine bureaucratic thing.
Yeah.
No, it directly fulfills a demand from anti-vaccine activists. That sets a very distinct tone right from the start, doesn't it, for the administration's whole approach to public health?
Yeah, it really does. It's a clear signal. And Jay Bhattacharya, who's head of the NIH, he's going to lead this task force.
Mm-hmm. And their stated goals are quite specific. They want to develop vaccines with fewer and less serious adverse reactions, improve how adverse reactions get reported, and generally support more vaccine safety research. They've got a deadline, too. The first report is due to Congress within 2 years, so we'll see recommendations relatively soon.
Right, but this is where the context and the controversy really come into sharp focus.
Exactly.
This whole move is being widely seen as the first concrete step towards HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s stated goal of completely upending the existing childhood immunization schedule.
Right, and the article points out that Children's Health Defense, that's the anti-vaccine group Kennedy himself founded, actually funded a lawsuit to force this task force's revival.
Wow, okay. So there's direct financial backing there.
Yeah. And Del Bigtree, who was Kennedy's former campaign communications director, is quoted expressing real excitement for what he called the Make America Healthy Again movement. So it's clearly linking this task force to a much broader political agenda.
And predictably, this has triggered quite a bit of alarm among the established medical community.
Oh, absolutely. Experts like Ann Zink, she is Alaska's former chief medical officer, and David Higgins, a pediatrician, they've voiced deep concern.
What's their main worry?
Their fear is that this task force, just by existing and by its framing, could end up undermining public trust in vaccines. They worry it'll overemphasize tiny, maybe even theoretical risks, while downplaying the real significant dangers, the diseases that current vaccines actually prevent pretty effectively.
Right. They're quick to point out that vaccines already go through incredibly rigorous safety testing, constant monitoring.
Exactly. Meticulous monitoring. So the whole premise of needing fundamentally safer vaccines might be misleading in a way that just erodes confidence.
Yeah. And Dort Race, a law professor, suggests this is basically just another forum Kennedy can populate with vaccine deniers. That's pretty blunt.
It is. It hints at a potential for a biased agenda rather than, you know, objective scientific inquiry. And Walter Orenstein, who was on a previous version of this task force, warns specifically against appointing members with known biases.
So who's actually on it right now?
For now, the initial membership is limited to officials from federal health agencies, NIH, CDC, FDA.
Okay.
But the concerns about future appointments and just the whole political framing of its mission, they definitely persist.
So this isn't just bureaucracy, is it? It feels like a stark example of political demands directly challenging scientific consensus.
It really is. And it creates ripples across public health. The core insight here seems to be that when trust in science gets politicized, the very foundations of public health can start to fracture.
So, for you listening, what does this signal about that balance between scientific consensus and political influence in public health going forward? And, you know, how might this directly affect your family's healthcare decisions if recommendations start diverging from established medical practice? It's a huge question.
It absolutely is. And tied directly to this, we see these broader implications for scientific research funding. The White House, under President Trump, has proposed truly drastic cuts in the 2026 budget request.
Drastic how?
We're talking a staggering 40% cut to the NIH and over half to the National Science Foundation, the NSF.
Wow, over half.
Yeah. The stated aim is slashing the nation's basic research portfolio by about a third.
That's just enormous. I mean, cutting NIH by 40%, what does that practically mean for, say, a research institution? Mm. Are labs just shutting down?
It's both, unfortunately. Labs slowing down, labs shutting down. The consequences are already being felt. UMass Chan Medical School, for instance, already faced a $37 million funding shortfall. Just one place.
And the impact.
That directly led to 200 layoffs or furloughs, about 3% of their staff, a hiring freeze since March, and nearly 90 rescinded graduate school offers. They managed to salvage 13, thankfully, but still.
Yeah, that paints a grim picture. It's not abstract numbers, it's people's jobs, aspiring scientists' careers just derailed.
Exactly. And beyond the hit to institutions, there's this worrying systemic erosion of data programs. Programs that are vital for understanding national issues, for informing policy.
Like what?
Well, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration stopped updating the Drug Abuse Warning Network, DAWN.
What does that track?
Drug-related emergency room visits. It's crucial for getting a real-time snapshot of the drug crisis. Without it, our understanding of emerging trends is just significantly hampered.
And that's not all, right?
No, the cuts go deeper. The CDC's Office on Smoking and Health closed, completely shut down.
Okay, right.
The National Youth Tobacco Survey, a primary source on youth nicotine use, vaping trends, its closure directly impacts our ability to monitor and respond. Even the education department missed its annual condition of education report deadline because of staff layoffs at the National Center for Education Statistics.
So it's not just numbers. It's our collective ability to see, to understand, and to effectively respond to critical challenges from health to education. Mm. We're losing the tools.
Precisely. Now, the administration, through officials like Michael Kratsios at the White House Science Office, they frame this as a targeted correction.
To do what?
To eliminate bias, promote gold standard science, which they define as focusing purely on basic science, cutting out red tape, implying, you know, that previous research was somehow biased or inefficient.
Right. And the White House spokeswoman, Taylor Rogers, claims this is all to restore America's trust in the BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
But scientists are sounding major alarm bells. Anastasia Kurova, a prominent researcher, called the cuts absolutely suicidal. That's strong language.
Yeah. And a Nobel laureate, Victor Ambros, speaks of extreme uncertainty in what used to be a robust, merit-based system that drew the world's best talent.
That's a powerful point. It's not just the immediate funding loss. It's a fundamental shift. Scientists are questioning if their careers are even viable anymore.
Like Jesse Lehman, fearing funding unpredictability.
Exactly. And Philip Zamor makes that undeniable point. Sickness doesn't have political boundaries. The implications are dire, and they're long-term. The Congressional Budget Office projects even a 10% NIH cut, much less than proposed, could mean two fewer drugs invented per year over 30 years.
Wow. We're sacrificing long-term investment for short-term cuts.
That's what it looks like. And what's truly remarkable, almost an inversion of history, is the international reaction.
What's happening there?
Aix-Marseille University in France launched a Safe Place for Science program, committed over $16 million to recruit 15 American scientific refugees.
Scientific refugees. That phrase alone is just jarring. A complete reversal of when European scientists sought refuge here.
It really makes you pause. And other European universities, the European Commission, they're joining this effort.
So, for you listening, how might these widespread cuts impact your future healthcare? The nation's ability to innovate, its global standing. What are those long-term societal costs of undervaluing science? It feels like we're actively turning away from what made the U.S. a scientific leader.
It certainly seems that way. And this pivot, or maybe political reorientation of science, it extends to specific fields, too, like mRNA vaccine development.
Right. There was an opinion piece on that.
Yes. Highlighting criticism from the AMA president, Bobby Mokamala, and others about NIH director Padacharya's op-ed announcing a pivot away from mRNA vaccines for broad public use.
And his reasoning was,
A perceived lack of public trust. That was the primary reason cited for this strategic shift.
But critics are pushing back hard on that narrative, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. They argue mRNA tech was absolutely crucial during COVID, saved millions of lives globally. They say vaccine hesitancy stems mainly from anti-vaccine advocates like Padacharya and RFK Jr. themselves, not from Biden-era policies.
Right. And they emphasize the NIH's core mission is research, discovery, not political positioning or, you know, catering to distrust fueled by misinformation.
What really stands out here is that profound tension between public health goals, scientific integrity, and the influence of political narratives.
So what are the implications for national preparedness against future pandemics if we disinvest from promising tech because of political pressure that isn't based on science?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
And for you, this really boils down to how important is public trust in science, especially health, and who's responsible for fostering it or eroding it? It feels pretty foundational.
Absolutely foundational.
Okay, let's pivot now from health and science to another major policy area dominating the headlines, immigration and federal power, and the expanded enforcement and local pushback it's generating.
Yeah, this section of the Post details a really significant increase in federal activity, particularly in D.C. It touches law enforcement, social services, often with considerable local resistance and, frankly, human consequences.
So President Trump declared an emergency in D.C., which has effectively put the city's police department under federal control.
That's right. Federal operations are now 24/7, targeting specific high-crime areas and visible signs of homelessness, what they're calling known hotspots. It's a dramatic shift for a city's policing autonomy.
And they've brought in the National Guard.
800 unarmed National Guard members, yeah. For visible presence and area beautification, that's military jargon for tidying up. But in this context, it takes on a more complex meaning.
Trump defended it, citing common sense and toughness. But what about the data? I thought crime was down in D.C.
Well, that's the controversy. D.C. police data actually shows violent crime declining since 2023. But Attorney General Pam Bondi's order justifying the federal control cited apparent efforts by some district employees to manipulate crime statistics.
But without evidence.
The article notes, without providing any supporting evidence, former D.C. officials are calling it strongman tactics. Mayor Bowser initially decried it as an authoritarian push, but now seems to be trying to work constructively, maybe recognizing her limited options.
This sounds like it's causing some serious policy whiplash locally.
Oh, definitely. D.C. Police Chief Pamela Smith rolled out a policy allowing limited police help in federal immigration enforcement, which pleased Trump. But Attorney General Bondi immediately rescinded Smith's order, said it didn't go far enough. Bondi then ordered an ND to dangerous sanctuary policies and appointed someone named Terry Cole as Emergency Police Commissioner.
With what power?
Approval power over all D.C. police directives. D.C.'s Attorney General Brian Schwab immediately called that appointment and the power grab unlawful. So expect major legal battles.
And who's being most affected by this federal surge?
It seems to be increasingly targeting vulnerable groups. Homeless individuals, encampment clearings near the Kennedy Center, happening with expedited 24-hour notices, not the usual 14 days.
Just displacing people faster.
Right. And undocumented immigrants. There's been a significant spike in ICE arrests, 29 on one Wednesday alone, compared to just 28 in almost all of July.
Wow.
And the human toll is clear. There's a story from Sofia Ramirez, her undocumented father, arrested after a routine traffic stop, impacting their ability to pay rent.
And D.C. is a sanctuary jurisdiction, right? Limiting cooperation with ICE.
It is. Which means the Department of Justice, under Bondi, is now threatening legal action against jurisdictions she claims are putting illegal aliens ahead of American citizens.
So for you listening, what are the implications when federal power expands so directly into local policing, social services, especially for vulnerable populations? And how do you balance public safety concerns with civil liberties and local autonomy? It's a fundamental tension.
Absolutely. And that tension isn't unique to D.C. We see similar aggressive stances elsewhere, like Florida, where Governor DeSantis is planning a second migrant detention facility.
A second one.
They're converting the Baker Correctional Institution, an old state prison in North Florida. Capacity for up to 1,300 detainees. Cost, $6 million. And they plan to set it up incredibly fast, 2 to 3 weeks.
That's after the controversial Alligator Alcatraz facility, right?
Exactly. The one in the Everglades that just started deportations in late July. And DHS Secretary Kristi Noem has even cited Alligator Alcatraz as a model for other states.
But it's facing criticism.
Significant criticism. State Rep. Anna Eskamani called Alligator Alcatraz an expensive grift, and this new site another dumb-named facility. She suggests the state might even be motivated by pending lawsuits against the Everglades Center.
Lawsuits about what?
Environmental groups, the Miccosukee tribe, civil rights lawyers. They've sued over its location and protected wetlands, poor conditions, and crucially, lack of legal access for detainees.
So Florida's aggressive stance means rapid expansion of detention, but with major legal and humanitarian questions hanging over it.
Definitely. It raises questions about the human costs, the financial costs of this rapid expansion, especially when conditions and legal access are challenged, and how these policies reflect those broader political narratives on immigration.
Okay, and tied into all this, there's a theme about data integrity and public trust really coming under scrutiny in this issue of the Post.
Yeah, it's quite striking. The paper highlights how the administration seems to be actively bending, maybe even manipulating, data to fit its political agenda.
Which is deeply concerning, right? It undermines informed decision-making. Like President Trump using inaccurate crime stats to justify the D.C. police takeover, even though local data showed a decline.
Right, and announcing plans for the census to stop counting undocumented immigrants, which has massive implications for political representation, federal funding allocation.
And then firing the Bureau of Labor Statistics Commissioner, Erica McAntarfer, after a weak jobs report, claiming the stats were rigged.
That one really sent shockwaves. It raises fundamental questions about objective data in a democracy. Statisticians, economists like Paul Schroeder, widely condemned the firing, warned of a chilling effect on all federal data collectors.
He compared it to
an airline pilot losing his instrument panel mid-flight. Basically, without reliable data, policymakers are flying blind.
Right. And while job report revisions are normal, making them seem politically motivated is dangerous. Plus, falling survey response rates and budget strains already challenge data reliability.
Exactly. This just undermines public confidence even further, right when we need reliable figures most.
And the article points to international examples where this kind of thing had devastating consequences.
Yeah, Greece, where statistical issues contributed to the debt crisis. Argentina, where data manipulation hindered policy and led to prosecutions. China, often accused of inflating economic figures.
But the administration's defense is...
Spokeswoman Taylor Rogers says Trump's actions are meant to restore trust so Americans can make their own decisions, claiming he's preserving, not eroding, democracy by ensuring data reflects reality, the implication being the previous reality was flawed.
But the impact goes beyond perception, right? Key data programs are being cut.
Severely diminished. We mentioned the Drug Abuse Warning Network, Dawn updates stopping, that hinders understanding the drug crisis.
And the CDC's Youth Tobacco Survey.
Gone, with the closure of the Office on Smoking and Health. And the Education Department missing its annual report deadline due to layoffs. It makes it much harder to track trends, inform policy across sectors, creates real blind spots.
What's really sobering is the long-term implication. These data gaps could last for years, maybe decades. And it could lead the public to view all government figures as inherently politicized, no matter who's in charge.
That's the fear.
So, for you listening, why should you care if government data is accurate and trusted? And how do you navigate a world where official facts are increasingly questioned or manipulated? What tools do you rely on? Okay, let's move beyond national borders now. The Post offers a crucial and somewhat unsettling look at geopolitics and international relations. It details a global order that seems to be shifting rapidly, bending to new pressures.
Yeah, it does. Let's start with the U.S.-Russia dynamic, especially regarding the war in Ukraine. It seems increasingly tense. Complex.
This section suggests a really concerning shift in U.S. foreign policy, one that appears to strategically favor Russia, with potentially devastating implications for alliances and conflicts.
That's the takeaway. The headlines from the summit really suggest that Putin has his way. The Post reports Trump dismissed Ukrainian President Zelensky's attendance at a key summit on U.S. soil.
Saying what?
Basically that Zelensky had been in many meetings and nothing happened, signaling a lack of value in his presence. Meanwhile, Putin scored a significant win.
Also,
a diversion of Trump's threat of tough sanctions on Russian oil, a critical economic lifeline. And he deflected Trump's calls for a ceasefire, basically gaining time.
And Trump is still blaming Zelensky for the war.
The article highlights that tendency, echoing Putin's narrative. Though it does note he seemed more conciliatory later in a video call with Zelensky and European leaders, maybe due to allied pressure.
What's the reaction from Europe?
Profound concern. Roderich Kiesewetter, a German MP, voiced fear that excluding Europe and Ukraine meant the end of the West as a collective alliance. A chilling thought. He expressed real fear for Ukrainians' fate.
And Russia's objectives seem pretty clear.
Yeah, Deputy Foreign Minister Ryabkov laid it out.
Yeah.
Normalize relations with the U.S. and sanctions, restore flights, enable business deals, and deflect blame for the war into Ukraine, hoping to halt U.S. intelligence and weapons support.
What about inside the Kremlin?
An unnamed former official noted widespread war fatigue, surprising, given the public face. But officials are scared to even talk compromise for fear of Putin. Expectations for the summit internally were low, predicting either an ultimatum to Ukraine or little real achievement.
So as you listen, how does a shift in U.S. policy like this, empowering adversaries, sidelining allies, affect global alliances and the path of conflicts like the war in Ukraine?
Which leads directly to the agonizing internal debates within Ukraine itself. The Post reports Ukrainians confront prospect of losing Donbass in Trump-Putin talks.
Putin wants the rest of Donbass, right? The eastern region.
That's his aim, seize the remaining 30%. But Zelensky has flatly rejected surrendering land. We will not leave Donbass, he said. Sets up an almost impossible diplomatic situation.
It sounds like a heartbreaking position for Ukrainians, torn between exhaustion from a four-year war and just sheer revulsion at rewarding Russia's invasion.
Deeply torn. Many are unwilling to accept any territory loss, even unofficially. They fear Russia would just regroup, rearm, and attack again later. Any peace would just be a temporary pause.
But there's another perspective emerging, too.
Yeah, a sobering, pragmatic one from some Ukrainian businessmen. They believe ceding land might be the only choice to actually stop the war, because people are sick and tired of the war, even if it means an unfavorable land swap.
And the human cost of that choice.
An opinion piece underscores it starkly. A forced withdrawal could trigger a new, massive wave of displacement like in 2022, on an already exhausted country facing winter without adequate housing. It draws parallels to Finland's painful experience losing Karelia after the Winter War.
And those who stay behind in ceded areas.
The peace notes, they might tragically be treated as collaborators. It's awful.
And politically, it could destabilize Ukraine internally.
A former high-ranking official warned exactly that. Any agreement involving concessions could lead to instability, which Russia would exploit. The conclusion, there's simply no good agreement for Ukraine in this scenario. A true no-win situation.
So for you listening, beyond the geopolitics, what are those profound human impacts? The agonizing internal debates a nation faces under prolonged attack when contemplating a peace that demands such sacrifice. What kind of impossible choice is that?
An unenviable position indeed. Shifting focus, other key bilateral relations are also strained, notably the U.S. and India. The Post's report, Trump-Modi standoff threatens U.S.-India relationship, reveals a rapid, concerning deterioration.
What's causing the friction?
Trump publicly called India a dead economy, imposed a 50% tariff for its Russian oil purchases, hitting their economy. India, meanwhile, is frustrated by stalled trade talks and Trump's claims of resolving its conflict with Pakistan unilaterally, which India insists is bilateral.
Sounds like mutual misunderstandings and grievances.
And a clash of foreign policy drivers plus personalities. Washington's irritated by India handling Pakistan bilaterally. Modi's government seems focused on its Hindu nationalist base at home, portraying him as a macho Hindu leader, sometimes overriding diplomacy.
And the personal relationship?
Christopher Clary at University at Albany notes the Trump-Modi personal relationship has broken, driven by huge egos. That personal dimension is critical, especially now when diplomacy seems vulnerable to leader styles.
How does the personalization of foreign policy affect things?
It can drastically alter global alignment, sometimes for reasons unrelated to traditional state interests.
And the geopolitical impact of this U.S.-India standoff?
Significant. Could shake the order in Asia, damage India's economy, undo years of partnership building. It's already pushing India closer to Russia. Putin visit planned, and China Modi visiting for the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, interested in BRICS, a clear shift away from Western alignments.
So for you, how do leaders' personalities and domestic politics influence complex international relationships? What are the global consequences when key partnerships fray like this?
This unraveling of traditional alliances brings us to a broader, sobering look at the international system itself, visible in crises like the protracted plight of Sudan. The article is stark. Sudan's many catastrophes are an indictment of a faltering international system.
The humanitarian crisis there sounds horrific and largely overlooked. Widespread deprivation, water, food shortages.
Weaponized rape and sexual violence used systematically. Abductions for ransom. The ICC prosecutor cites reasonable grounds to believe war crimes and crimes against humanity are ongoing in Darfur. It's devastating.
But it gets little attention from the White House, even with Trump as a self-proclaimed global peacemaker.
Very little mention. The previous Biden administration's actions, genocide declaration, sanctions were largely symbolic, didn't change things on the ground. And critically, Trump's decision to gut USA.
A major aid agency.
Right. It had direct catastrophic consequences in Sudan. Clinic closures, life-saving assistance drying up, a direct line from Washington policy to lives lost.
And external powers are involved, too.
A thicket of geopolitical interests. Egypt, Turkey, Russia, Gulf monarchies, all implicated, sometimes subtly, sometimes overtly, in fueling the conflict by backing different sides. The Sudanese military even claimed to shoot down an Emirati plane carrying Colombian mercenaries aligned with the RSF, one of the main warring factions.
Wow. An Emirati plane with Colombian mercenaries.
It reveals the complex web of external involvement.
And the article offers a systemic indictment.
Yes. It states the intractable nature of the war and the ubiquity of suffering is an indictment of a faltering international system, reflecting a new shape of global politics.
How is that interpreted?
Some see it as the end of the liberal world order, where multilateralism and human rights were supposedly paramount. Others argue it actually shows what the American order looks like. Collusion with the military-industrial complex, disregard for humanitarians, tolerance of abusive regimes when interests align, uncomfortable truths.
So for you, why do some crises get less attention than others? What does Sudan reveal about the effectiveness, the priorities of the global political system in addressing widespread suffering? It's a harsh mirror.
It really is. Finally, in this international sweep, we look at internal conflicts, specifically Israel's strategic rift over Gaza, revealing deep fault lines within its leadership.
What's the core conflict there?
A significant public clash between Prime Minister Netanyahu and his military brass, led by IDF Chief Zamir, over plans to retake all of Gaza. Netanyahu told Fox News he intended to, but then climbed down.
Indicating pushback from the military.
Strong pushback. It shows the lasting power of the Israeli army brass, their institutional weight. The security establishment unanimously pushed back against the political leadership, successfully reducing the plan's scope.
And this points to deeper issues.
What the article calls extraordinary infighting, a belief among senior officers that further ambitious goals in Gaza are simply unachievable. Netanyahu's feuded bitterly with his generals for years. His own son even accused the army chief of attempting a military coup, shows the raw intensity.
And the human cost continues to mount.
Staggering, after 22 months, 20 Israeli hostages still reportedly held, over 61,000 Palestinians killed, a devastating blockade causing widespread hunger.
And Israel's international standing.
Severely damaged, according to senior defense officials, alarmed by the long-lasting damage. Exemplified by Germany, a crucial ally halting military exports, like Merkava tank engines. Significant diplomatic isolation.
So for you listening, how do these internal power struggles within a government affect military strategy, international relations, especially during a prolonged conflict? And what are the implications when military and political leaders profoundly disagree on the nation's path? Okay, transitioning now from that grand scale of geopolitics and national policy, let's bring our focus closer to home, exploring society and daily life, delving into the human experience, the local landscape as portrayed in the Post.
Yeah, let's do that. We'll start with domestic politics and legal battles, looking at elections, individual rights, and how they intersect with commerce.
This next section gives a fascinating, sometimes intense glimpse into the mechanics of political power at the state and local level, how it's sought, how it's defended, often with real human costs.
Definitely. First up, the intricate dance of electoral strategy and redistricting, particularly in Texas. We're hearing GOP maps bet big on Latino vote and about the dramatic Texas Democrats walkout.
So Texas Republicans are drawing new congressional maps to secure House control, banking heavily on Latino voters.
That's the strategy. Five new districts drawn where Trump would have won by at least 10 points in 2024. But its complex Hidalgo County, which Trump flipped, still voted Democrat down ballot in other races. Shows nuanced loyalty.
Yeah, conversations with voters like Yesenia Cure voted Trump but isn't Republican, and Rick Salinas called the GOP bet crazy a show. It's not simple.
Right. Carlos Odio of Equus Research notes some Democratic vote might be gone for the foreseeable future, but a big portion remain persuadable, highlights the evolving nature of this key bloc.
And the Texas Democrats took drastic action, leaving the state.
Dozens of them did, yeah. To deny the House the two-thirds quorum needed for the redistricting vote effectively halted legislative action.
And what were the consequences for them?
Civil arrest warrants, threats of expulsion, $500 daily fines, hefty compared to their $7,200 annual salary. Governor Abbott vows to keep calling special sessions a real standoff.
And the personal costs sound significant.
Huge. Rep. Linda Garcia brought her 9-year-old son, faced bomb threats, separation from families, lost income. Rep. Vince Perez had police show up outside his 90-year-old neighbor's house, apparent intimidation.
Wow.
Rep. Lalani called it very stressful, but a smaller price to pay for democracy, emphasizes the principles at stake.
And there was that related incident with Border Patrol outside a Democratic event in L.A.?
Yeah, Governor Newsom and others called it an intimidation tactic. DHS said it was just enforcing the law. Adds another layer of tension.
So this is a high-stakes battle over power, the future of maps, representation, and the personal sacrifices involved in political protest. It really highlights that shifting landscape for Latino voters, too.
Definitely. So for you, how do redistricting efforts directly impact your representation? And what personal costs are people willing to bear for causes they see as fundamental to democracy?
And as Democrats grapple with redistricting, they're also strategizing intensely for the Senate. The article notes, Schumer's familiar recruits gird Democrats' slog to retake Senate.
Right. The strategy seems to be shifting, prioritizing older, familiar figures with established brands in critical races. Like Sherrod Brown, 72, challenging John Husted in Ohio.
That's a departure from calls for a new generation.
A notable departure, yeah. It reveals this ongoing internal debate in the Democratic Party, electability versus generational change.
So who's arguing for what?
Liberal activists push for younger candidates to connect with younger voters, address voter recoil against older politicians, a sentiment that grew post-Biden. But experienced party operatives favor candidates with proven track records, name recognition, statewide appeal, especially in tough states like Ohio that have trended Republican.
It sounds like a real tug of war.
Yeah.
What do past results suggest?
The mixed signals, fueling both sides. Former Senator John Tester, 68, who lost in 24, said candidly, Democrats make this mistake too often. We try to recycle candidates, citing failures in 2016.
Right. Bay, Feingold, Strickland.
Exactly. But other former governors, Kane, Warner, Shaheen, who ran shortly after leaving office, had more success. Suggests maybe executive experience offers a different kind of proven track record.
And Republicans are ready with the career politician attack line.
Oh, absolutely. Cory Gardner at the NRSC made that clear. It's a potent label today.
So this reveals those deep strategic calculations in tough Senate races and that internal debate about electability versus change. It makes you think, for you listening, when you consider candidates, what matters most? Experience. Fresh face. Specific stance.
It's a key question for voters.
Okay, from electoral politics, let's shift to legal battles and the complexities of free speech, especially online and in public spaces. A big one. Supreme Court clears way for Miss Law requiring parental consent to use social media.
Yeah, this is a really complex area, trying to balance online safety for minors with broad First Amendment rights. The court allowed a Mississippi law requiring age verification and parental consent for under 18s on social media to stay in effect during lower court challenges.
And the law also mandates screening content.
Right. Screening for things like self-harm, drug use, a broader attempt to regulate what minors access online.
And the tech industry's reaction.
Not happy. NetChoice, representing Google, Reddit, Meta, argues it poses grave First Amendment harms, burdening both teens and adults' access to protected speech.
But Justice Kavanaugh suggested.
In a concurrence, he indicated he expects NetChoice to ultimately prevail in litigation, suggesting the law might face serious constitutional challenges down the road.
This follows other rulings on online content, right?
It does. Second ruling in months on youth online safety after upholding a Texas age verification law for porn sites. But the court also previously rejected federal efforts to pressure social media on misinformation and ordered reexamination of Texas and Florida laws preventing platforms from removing political posts.
So it's a very complex, almost contradictory legal landscape.
Highly complex. Courts are really grappling with balancing various rights and societal concerns online.
So for you, where should the line be drawn between protecting kids online and safeguarding free expression for everyone, including teens? It's a debate shaping our digital future.
Absolutely. And speaking of government and media, we have this compelling case of Kari Lake defending her actions at Voice of America in court after warnings from Capitol Hill.
Right. Lake was installed by Trump to reduce VOA and its parent agency, USAGM, to a minimum presence.
Exactly. And she's now defending those drastic dismantling efforts in court. The Post reports most of the 1,300 employees and contractors were put on leave or fired. Only about 200 active staff left.
That's a dramatic reduction.
It's very swift and dramatic. And there's intense legal and congressional pushback.
What form is that taking?
VOA's sideline director and journalists sued Lake, arguing Trump lacks authority to unilaterally dismantle a congressionally mandated agency. Judge Royce Lambreth questioned the waste of taxpayer funds for paid leave. The GAO launched an investigation into potential executive overreach.
Blame Congress.
Staffers from both parties warned Lake about misusing funds and violating prohibitions on reorganizing without congressional permission. Shows bipartisan concern.
What's Lake's defense?
She intends to help Trump close USAGM legally. Justified cutting services to four languages by claiming VOA far exceeded its original mandate. Plans to supplement content with right-wing networks like OAN and Newsmax. Move HQ out of D.C. Use AI for graphics. A clear shift.
And the critics. VOA journalists.
Describe her plans as overtly partisan, contrary to VOA's mandate as a reliable and authoritative source of news. Suggest politicization of a traditionally objective outlet. Lake fires back, accusing the GAO and Democrats of trying to stop Trump's right-sizing of a corrupt agency broadcasting an anti-American message.
Wow. This highlights a huge tension over the independence of state-funded media, limits of executive power, potential politicization.
It really does. So for you, what is the role of government-funded media internationally? What happens when its objectivity is compromised by political agendas?
Finally, in this section, a striking example of corporate decisions navigating the culture wars. Costco deciding not to sell abortion pills after pressure from conservatives.
Yeah, this is a clear illustration of how major corporations get caught in these broader political and social debates, balancing diverse stakeholder pressures, often from opposing sides.
So Costco decided not to dispense mifepristone, a key abortion pill, at its pharmacies.
That's right. Seen as a significant win for conservative and religious groups who pressured them for over a year.
This follows CVS and Walgreens getting FDA certification to sell the pill earlier.
Exactly. Back in March 2024, NYC Comptroller Brad Lander urged others, including Costco, to follow suit, citing public health and shareholder interests. NYC Pensions owned over $440 million in Costco shares.
But there was counterpressure.
Immense counterpressure. A coalition of conservative religious financial groups, Alliance Defending Freedom, Inspire Investing, holding $56 million in stock plus thousands of members, petitioned against it.
And Costco's stated reason.
Lack of demand from our members and other patients.
But important context here. Medication abortion is still accessible in all 50 states via remote prescription and mail.
Right. This isn't a total block on access, but a change in one specific retail channel. Still, it shows how corporate decisions on sensitive issues aren't just business choices. They reflect societal values, impact healthcare access, become battlegrounds.
So for you, how do these corporate decisions reflect your values? What impact do they have on access and choices in your community? Okay, moving into our final part, society and daily life. We're delving into the more everyday human aspects, community, culture, local happenings. Let's start with environmental and local concerns, protecting or sometimes failing to protect our spaces.
Yeah, these stories highlight really tangible impacts human action, industrial legacies on local environments and communities. Remind us how quickly familiar landscapes can change and how persistent unseen threats can be.
First, a story that sounds almost unbelievable. A Minnesota lake vanishes, leaving a pile of dead fish. Lake Alice, 26 acres in a state park, drained to a paltry stream.
Because a valve got stuck open during maintenance. Catastrophic.
And the impact.
Lake bed exposed matted algae, sand, piles of dead fish. Locals tried rescuing some. Area closed for water recreation. A strong smell dead fish. Low water levels expected for 4-6 weeks disrupts the whole ecosystem.
Wow. A stark reminder of how human infrastructure malfunctions can just dramatically alter natural environments. What does it mean for a community when a familiar landscape just vanishes like that?
It's profound. And from sudden disappearance to persistent unseen contamination. Forever chemicals leave a Emmion community worried.
This is in Elkton, Maryland. high levels of PFOA, these forever chemicals, in well water.
Exactly. Linked to the WL Gore facility, the Gore-Tex people. These chemicals persist indefinitely, linked to serious health problems.
Yeah.
Cancer, high cholesterol, infertility.
The long-term legacy of industrial pollution.
Precisely. A former employee sued Gore in 2022, then a class action in 23, then a state lawsuit by Maryland in 24, alleging Gore knew since the late 80s but concealed it. Gore denies concealment.
What levels are we talking about?
Well water up to 800 parts per trillion PPT, groundwater up to 1300 PPT. Some EPA advisories recommend levels as low as 4 PPT. So significantly elevated, serious health risk.
And Gore's response?
Claims limited impact. Offering filtration systems 84 installed or connections to local utilities for 13 homes, but residents remain deeply worried.
Highlights the challenge of regulating private wells, historical pollution, the ongoing legal and health battles.
Oh, absolutely. So for you, how do hidden contamination dangers affect your community's health, quality of life? What's the corporate role in addressing historical pollution legally and ethically?
Okay, let's explore how communities are connecting and confronting issues through culture and daily life. A really heartwarming story from Maryland. Which fathers know best? The inaugural Dad Games.
This sounds like a genuinely great community initiative, fostering connection, combating isolation. The Dad Games in Upper Marlboro had competitions like the one-trip grocery bag relay.
Ah, I can picture that.
The diaper change race, dad joke competition. Founded by Joshua DuBois, aiming to celebrate fathers, build community, and specifically combat isolation and loneliness among men. Provide a space for connection.
And there was a mental health component, too.
Yeah, mental health coaches were on site, proceeds subsidized counseling sessions, underscores a deeper purpose beyond just fun.
Clearly fostered positivity, appreciation, a fun environment for connection, role modeling. Really innovative.
Yeah.
Makes you think, how are communities creating new spaces for support, especially for groups like fathers? What simple acts build community where you live?
Great questions. From community building to more unconventional protest, the Post delves into eggs, tomatoes, sandwiches, the history of food as protest projectiles.
There's a history to this.
Surprisingly long and colorful, and traces it back to Roman Emperor Vespasian allegedly had turnips thrown at him, then through incidents with eggs, pies, milkshakes, notes their symbolic power as visible, non-lethal dissent.
And it's still happening.
Very much alive. Recounts a recent incident, a man, Sean Charles Dunn, a Justice Department employee, since fired, arrested for throwing a Subway sandwich at a federal officer in D.C.
A Subway sandwich.
Wow. The article also notes Trump's past fears of being hit by pineapples, tomatoes, bananas at rallies, and mentions a D.C. woman who pleaded guilty to assaulting officers after spitting on a former U.S. attorney. Shows various forms persist.
So these seemingly trivial acts offer a lens into protest forms, legal consequences, symbolic weight.
Exactly. What does it tell you about societal tensions, free expression, when mundane objects become protest tools? Where's the line between symbolic dissent and criminal behavior?
And for something completely different, a puzzle that's fascinated people for decades is nearing resolution. The secret of CIA's crypto sculpture, unsolved for 35 years, is up for sale.
This is truly fascinating, a real-life mystery. Artist Jim Sanborn is auctioning the solution to K4, the final, notoriously hard unsolved passage of his encrypted sculpture at CIA headquarters.
Auctioning the solution. How much could it fetch?
Estimated $300,000 to $500,000. The secret transferred via armored vehicle. Sanborn says the piece destroyed marriages, attracted unwanted guests, even threatened my life. He feels the burden of keeping secrets, wants control over the solution now.
It's become a phenomenon, hasn't it? A publicity coup for the CIA, even.
Totally. Fascinated a global community of code breakers, amateur and pro. Sanborn gets thousands of messages, even developing an AI phone line for people to test solutions.
Highlights our fascination with puzzles, secrets, art meeting intelligence.
Yeah. So for you, what makes an unsolved mystery so compelling? What happens to a secret's power once it's revealed, or, like here, sold? Does it lose its magic?
Moving into the lighter but still impactful realm of pop culture and entertainment, huge story. Taylor Swift's unprecedented interview on Travis Kelce's New Heights podcast.
A major breakthrough for Swift, who's usually so guarded about her personal life. An unusually long, candid conversation.
What did she reveal?
Announced her new album, The Life of a Showgirl, release date October 3rd. Discussed her two-year relationship with Kelce, her fight to buy back her master recordings, rumored cost $360 million. Her father's recent health scare, life pre-post-eras tour, a really holistic view.
Caused an internet meltdown among Swifties, I bet.
Absolutely. A unique blend of personal revelation, music industry business lessons, Oni Masters is key, and celebrity connection.
Makes you think, how is the celebrity audience relationship changing with platforms like podcasts? What does it mean when public figures share more intimately like this?
It definitely reshapes perception.
From global pop to enduring live theater, The Post celebrates Arena Stage in D.C. Bravo, Arena Stage, bravo, celebrating 75 years.
A truly foundational institution of American regional theater, celebrating 75 years. Founded by Zelda Fye Chandler, pioneered a permanent, fully racially integrated acting company, groundbreaking at the time.
What are some milestones?
Premiered The Great White Hope, launched James Earl Jones' career, won a Pulitzer and Tony. Received the first regional theater Tony Award ever. Its 2010 Meade Center building is architecturally significant. Hanna S. Sharif is the fourth artistic director planning an ambitious season.
Showcases the enduring power of live theater for social commentary, innovation, even urban revitalization.
Definitely. So for you, what role do local arts institutions play in your community's identity, cultural vibrancy? How do they reflect or shape narratives?
The paper also looks at recent films. Spike Lee's Highest to Lowest, a remake of Kurosawa's High and Low, starring Denzel.
Yeah, described as a fast, funky thriller, explores an ethical dilemma around a kidnapping set against a vibrant NYC backdrop, shows Lee's ability to infuse commentary into a high-stakes narrative.
Then Americana, Western crime noir with Sidney Sweeney.
Called a Fargo wannabe that struggles with tone, involves chasing a Native American artifact, touching on heritage, exploitation.
And Selimene's Story.
An empathetic immigrant tale. Parisian food delivery man preparing for an asylum interview, praised for its raw lead performance by a first-time Guinean actor, brings a human face to immigration.
Finally, Nobody 2. Bob Odenkirk back as the assassin dad.
Yep. Stylized action, exploring themes of making memories amidst violence, suggests a deeper layer. These films reflect diverse approaches, commentary, entertainment, exploring complex human experiences.
So what draws you to certain films? How do movies reflect or influence how you see the world?
Shifting to sports highlights, the Nationals baseball team is undergoing a youth movement. Rookie Dylan Cruz returns, veteran Nathaniel Lowe designated for assignment, clear shift for a team struggling at 49-72.
And golfer Ben Griffin's comeback.
Incredible story. Quit golf 4 years ago, now a top PGA player eyeing the Ryder Cup. A story of reclamation, second chances, resilience.
Lakers honoring Pat Riley.
With a statue, joining other legends, cements his legacy as an architect of championship eras, underscores leadership impact.
And the NBA schedule is out.
Yep. Highlighting key matchups for new media deals. Anthony Edwards, T-Wolves in primetime. Cavaliers Thunder touted as potential finals preview. These stories show change, perseverance, legacy in sports. So beyond scores, what does sports teach you about individual journeys, team dynamics, historical impact?
And finally, rounding out our deep dive, a cultural and economic trend converging in D.C. Gold rush comes to Trump's Washington.
This is quite symbolic, ties economics and political aesthetics. Gold prices surged 35% over the past year, beating stocks. Investors see it as a safe asset amid uncertainty. Central banks are diversifying, buying gold.
And this is reflected visually in the White House.
Reportedly, yeah. The Oval Office under Trump transformed with overwhelming bold-colored decor, drapes, medallions, figurines, reflects Trump's style and the administration's golden age narrative.
Gold dealers are busy.
Reporting a surge. People converting crypto to bullion, seeing gold as a hedge against inflation or doubt in the dollar's reserve status. Nearly half the price surge linked to global economic uncertainty, particularly over trade policy.
Ties economic trends to political symbols. Highlights a shift to traditional safe havens.
Exactly. So how do economic indicators like gold, even aesthetic choices in leadership, reflect the prevailing mood, anxieties, priorities of a nation? It's a striking visual metaphor.
So as we've journeyed through this really comprehensive edition of the Washington Post, we've seen a world grappling with the nature of truth itself, the exercise of power often contentious, and the evolving ways we connect and confront both globally and, you know, right in our own communities.
Yeah. From those charged debates over vaccine safety and data integrity, to the profound personal costs of political protest, the dramatic reshaping of international alliances, each story offers a unique, critical lens into this intricate web of our modern world.
And all of this raises, I think, a crucial question for you listening. In an era where information can be deliberately bent, where alliances are reshaped by individual wills, where even a single newspaper holds so many different, sometimes conflicting narratives, how do you decide what truly informs and shapes your understanding of the world?
And maybe more importantly, what will you personally choose to explore more deeply to ensure your own insights are as nuanced as the world itself?
That's our deep dive for today.
Thank you for joining us. We hope you feel a little more well-informed, maybe a bit more curious.
Until next time, keep digging deeper.